Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
Thanks to Screwfix.ie, championing the trade with a choice of over 20,000 quality trade products.
Now, welcome back. We're reviewing the Sunday Papers. We're live here on Off the Ball, obviously. We're also streaming on Facebook and Twitter and Periscope and every which way you want us. We have Gary O'Toole, Olympian, in studio, and Paul Kimmage as well, from the Sunday Independent, independently of each other.
Also an Olympian, by the way.
Excuse me?
Also an Olympian.
Sorry, yeah. That's true. And, well, he's also a consultant orthopaedic surgeon. What else do you do?
I'm a plumber.
Independently of each other, they brought in cake, actually, for everyone, which is quite the gesture. We've never had two guests bring in cake, so thank you for that. It's, it's quite a treat
welcome
for everyone. So I'll get to the back pages very firstly then. It's all Mourinho yesterday at Stamford Bridge, as you might imagine. Chelsea and Manchester United drawing 2-2. More red rage. Jose has to be restrained after tempers boil over at the bridge, is the Sunday World. Sport Star Sunday have drawful. Sarri says sorry for bust up, but Mourinho's only raging at result. Sunday Mirror then. They touch on the Mourinho situation. Mourinho's rook of the draw at the top, and then they have an exclusive, they say, regarding Raheem Sterling, who is looking for £300,000 a week in his new contract, and Manchester City are not keen to do that. Sun Sport then. We're so sorry. Sorry as in S-A-R-R-I, Jose. Blues apology after goal jibes see Mourinho flip. And then rugby on the back page of the Mail on Sunday. Reds roar back, Gloucester lose Cipriani and a match as improving Munster show worth, is the headline there. Bottom right corner, chemical ban, O'Neill can't get basics right, it's not good enough. And then United denied, but Mourinho shows he's still up for the fight, is their back page. And then these two front pages. Gary, I think you had an observation to make here. We had the Sunday Independent, again it's on Mourinho. Sarri says sorry after Mourinho's return to Bridge ends in chaos. Picture there of Mourinho face to face with Sarri. And then we have the Sunday Times Sports section, which captures the moment that Sarri's assistant is saying whatever he has to say to Jose Mourinho. Take that, Jose. Mourinho furious as Chelsea assistant taunts him over Barkley's last gasp equaliser. And we have Jose on the dugout looking up at his taunter.
What a tramp. Look at the state of him. He's a bloody jumper hanging out of his back. How did he get on the sideline?
Well, he's an assistant coach, Paul. That's where they're supposed to stay.
He could have dressed up at least.
He was just after running down the touchline and jumping up and down and celebrating.
I'd say he's probably got a substitute's jacket or a top tied around him as the substitute went on earlier on. But the point about the two front pages is that the front page of the Sunday Times is in the moment when Mourinho's looking aghast and shocked at his behaviour and his behaviour. And then the second front page, the Sunday Independent one, is the calculated Jose Mourinho saying, let me at him, as he's walking down the tunnel. So Jose has had time to calculate what his best response would be by the time the Sunday Independent picture is taken. And I was listening to Off the Ball yesterday, and Nathan was saying, they should have just let him go after him, you know, and then just
what
see what happened.
Hold me back.
Hold me back, exactly.
I would have been of that camp. Let him go. I mean, no one runs onto the pitch when a football player is going after another football player. It's usually left up to teammates. There's no official intervention. So I would have liked to have seen what would have happened if he had caught up with him.
Have you the Observer there, Joe, no?
No, but I'll just hold up quickly. The front page of the Mirror, show us the Observer in just 1 second. Front page of the Mirror, $1 million Katie. So Taylor packs a punch in the US as world's highest paid female fighter, and they've some details inside of Katie's financial power at the moment. And then very lastly, Sunday Business Post doesn't always make the front page section of the papers. But Gary, you're very excited about are you Notre or are you Notre?
Notre Dame.
Okay, yeah. Notre Dame are playing Navy again in Dublin in 2020.
Yes.
People remember this happened in 2012. 60 million it's worth to the economy as well. Why are you excited?
It's worth an awful lot. Notre Dame are my second team in American college football. I'm a Michigan Wolverine supporter, and every year go to a Wolverines game. This year it's the game against the Buckeyes of Ohio State. So we're off to Columbus, Ohio in 4 weeks' time. But Notre Dame, the Fighting Irish, they kind of being adopted by Irish people over here. But the impact that it makes on the local economy here in Dublin is huge. 36 extra transatlantic flights over 3 days to bring the fans in. That's 10,000 fans coming in. Their spending power is huge. There's a Navy ship parked off Dunleary for the duration of the time. The Navy shipmen are around Dublin. It's just great if we can attract them back again in 2020. Great for tourism. And quite apart from all of that, it's usually a very entertaining game that Notre Dame usually win easily against the Navy. But Notre Dame are a strange powerhouse in American college football. They're not part of any conference. They're independent. They bring their own independent TV company with them. They play a game against the Navy because of tradition. They play a game against Stanford because of tradition, and a game against USC for tradition. And then they pick and choose who they're going to play. And the first game this year that they played was against Michigan, University of Michigan, the Wolverines, and they beat them. So that was my game, you know, my first and second team playing against one another that I support. And Notre Dame have gone on, they're unbeaten, the same as the big powerhouse of American college football is Alabama, who won again last night. So they're 7-0, the same as Notre Dame. And for Notre Dame to make it to the playoffs without being part of a conference is going to be a groundbreaking year if that happens this year, because Notre Dame, since they went independent, have never been good enough to make it to playoffs. So I'm actually going on a little bit too long about this.
What does 7-0? What does 7-0 mean?
Played 7, won 7, lost none.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Right. That's how all American sports are expressed.
I need to have a chat with you about how you're spending your leisure time.
Where do you
anyway,
get the time?
It's great to see Notre Dame coming back. I actually wrote to the president of Notre Dame after the last time they
were here. Well, of
course
you did.
And the president of Notre Dame wrote back to me.
Wow.
The president of Notre Dame is a priest, and he wrote back saying how much they enjoy their time here. But I also wrote to the general of the Navy, and he wrote back as well.
Why would you do that?
Because I really
enjoyed
the game.
What's wrong with you?
Enjoyed the game. I thought it was a fantastic sporting occasion, and they were so well behaved. The students of the respective colleges were so well behaved, and it was just lovely to see young people enjoying their sport, playing it for nothing. This is amateur sport, and coming out and enjoying it. And the respect of the fans in the stadium that day, it was just extremely. Pleasing to be a part of, and there's no point in walking away from that and then just closing the door. People need to know that that's a good and to be praised for good behavior, because there's so much loutish behavior. There's so much people in stands headlining the Observer like on a stag do, you know, and then the players go over and applaud them at the end of the game. For what? For cursing, for chanting racist abuse at people. It has to stop, you know. So when something good happens, they should be praised. That's what I think. And right. If something bad happens, I'll take a pot shot of them as well. But when it's good, they need to know about it.
As ever, meeting you makes me feel very inferior.
Yeah, me too.
It's the one downside. Yeah. It's the only downside. You bring cake, you write letters to priests and to the Navy, and I wonder what I'm doing with my time.
But more people should do it, you know. Everyone's negative, you know, down on the negative side of things. So with that said, here's my pal Paul Kimmich. And, he's going to take it from here.
Were they handwritten letters that you wrote?
Yes.
Of course they were.
And I have a special pen that I write these with.
Is that right?
Yeah.
How many letters might you write a week?
No, I wouldn't write more than one letter a year. Well, those two went together in the same year, but they were the same event, but never more than one a year.
Well, can you just send me the president's address and I'll send him a letter? Yeah.
The paper review is brought to you at Screwfix.ie, championing the trade with a choice of over 20,000 quality trade products. The Observer front page you mentioned.
Yeah, I've actually left it outside in my bag.
Okay, one of the lads will get it and we'll come back to it then.
Yeah, because it's really brilliant. It's a kind of a Caravaggio flair to it.
Well, let's come back to that in a second. Stuart Lancaster, I'd initially read him in the Sindo was the first one that I picked up, and he's really good. I'd assumed it was a one-on-one because he was talking about things of a delicate nature, not least the passing of his father very recently and very suddenly at 78 years of age and his family life. But it turns out he must have been doing this in a group, I don't know how big, on a Tuesday.
Well, I was... it was flagged for me. John Burns did a tweet. John Burns is a news editor at the Sunday Times, and he sent out a tweet say with a front page of the paper, of the newspaper, of the Sunday Times newspaper. And it's flagged across the masthead, how Stuart Lancaster was saved by Leinster. Which is, I'll read that, absolutely. It's an excellent headline, and I kind of thought, geez, that would have been great if we'd got that, we being my newspaper, the Sunday Independent. And I opened the Sunday Independent and I realised, well, we actually did have it. And then I opened the Mail on Sunday and they've got it as well. Now, we would look at the papers differently, I would suggest. You would look at it as a consultant surgeon, and I would look at it as a...
I'd look at it as a consumer, a consumer of papers and a reader of papers.
As a consumer and reader of papers,
I wouldn't look at them as a journalist. No, that's what you're saying, is it?
Yeah, well, yeah, I suppose that's what I'm trying to say. Not as eloquently as you, obviously. So I would look at it, I would look at them slightly differently. And being that the man that I am, I was fascinated by the fact that this is an interview that appears in three papers as to how the journalists would go about it and what they would say. Because I personally wouldn't do this. I don't do group interviews. It's one-on-one and nothing for me. So I was surprised. Well, not surprised, but I read the three pieces. So if you go through the piece, so Brendan Fanning has done it for the Sunday Independent. So I just said, well, I'll read the three opening paragraphs because, again, it's nuts and bolts. It's carpentry for me in the same way surgery is probably for you. So I'm looking at how do they start? What point will they pick up for as their starting point? And Brendan Fanning starts his with a story about his dad, Stuart Lancaster's dad, who died last year. Stuart Lancaster was a year into his job at Leinster when a colleague across the water brought up the issue of Super Rugby, as in how keen Lancaster was to work in that environment at some point in his career. Okay, then he goes on to his father and his father dying. And really very moving stuff and very interesting stuff from Lancaster about his dad. And then you pick up the Sunday Times. I'm not sure where how Leinster saved them comes into it. That isn't quite explored, but... Peter Riley in the Sunday Times said, how come Leinster are playing the best rugby in Europe? Ask the players, and the first thing they'll mention is the quality of their training sessions under Stuart Lancaster. Fresh, innovative, lung-busting, brain-stretching, competition-based drills designed to make the hurly-burly of real matches seem almost comfortable. And he tells a story about all of the notes and files that Lancaster has gathered over the years and how he delves into them from time to time, and he used one of them just the day before, and basically how fresh and innovative he is in his thinking. So that's, I'll read more of that. And then in the Mail, you've got Kieran Kennedy, who starts with Lancaster's commute every day, or commute this week. Off the top of his head, Stuart Lancaster estimates taking somewhere in the region of 160 flights between Dublin and Leeds every year. Last week was the same as most others, a flurry of training pitches, airports and early rises. He caught the 8 a.m. flight to Leeds in the morning after Leinster's Heineken Champions Cup defeat of Wasps to spend the weekend with his family. On his two-day trip home, he re-watched the 52-3 hammering of Wasps while also finding time to squeeze in Bat v Toulouse. He flew back to Dublin on Sunday night, spent Monday with the Leinster squad. Tuesday was a day off, but he and the head coach, Leo Cullen, were working at Leinster's training base. So he's basically given a sense of the toll, I suppose, that commuting to Leeds, where his wife still lives, takes on Lancaster as part of his work. So again, a different start and a piece that lends you to keep reading. So I would want to commend the three writers for that. I think it's really interesting. I just wondered if they'd colluded, you know, at the end of the group. Well, how are you going to start? And how are you going to start? And how are you going to start? Now, I obviously know they didn't do that and would never do that. But I find it was an interesting way. And all three pieces work.
They all work for me too. And he is a very engaging man. And just to say that I've met him. I met him a couple of years ago when he just moved to Leinster. And we just happened to be standing beside one another at a bar ordering. And the bar was relatively quiet. And
what was he ordering?
I can't remember the details of what he was ordering, nor what I was ordering.
That's interesting. I'd want to know what he wants to drink. What does Stuart Lancaster have to drink?
So he was there with his wife.
An ale. And,
I don't know what it was.
Right.
But the point was, I turned to him and I recognised who he was. And he was within a group of a lot of Leinster supporters. And he had just come in quietly
ordering the drink, and I turned to him and I said, "Oh, hi." He said, "Hello." And I said, "Thanks very much for coming over. I think you're going to be great here. This is soon after we start." Mm. And I said, "I think it'll be good for both of us that this mix goes
on into the future." And he said, "Well, why do you say that?" And I said, "Well, because I think you were unfairly treated over by England." He said, "Oh, thanks very much." And he went on, and he spoke to me for about 10 minutes, just standing there, handed out his drinks, and he stood there telling me how his children were still in school at that stage, and that he was commuting back and forth, and how he was managing this, and what he wanted for the future. And things haven't changed. He's been doing that now since he came here, and that he wouldn't move over here because he wanted them to stay in school over there, and that was his first priority. And I always got the impression that he was really content at what he had found here, and it's obviously had a huge influence. I think they both work well together, himself and Leo Cullen, it's quite obvious that the players have a huge respect for him. You know, every time a player is interviewed, and I listened to a podcast during the week of Johnny Sexton, and he was effusive in his praise.
Yeah, I think it was in Brendan's piece where Brendan makes the point that you've got the dynamic between the head coach Leo Cullen, Lancaster, and Sexton. That's what's making it work. The kind of three of these guys all on the same page, all looking to do the same things. And the dynamic of that relationship is what's making that work, or helping to make it work. And I think you've got to give huge credit. I mean, Lancaster is clearly a very, very admirable man. But equally so, Leo Cullen, who, you know, has no ego, had no problem with Lancaster coming on board, given the profile that he had, didn't feel undermined by it. And it's working really famously. Yeah. It seems to be at the moment.
Yeah, and I mean, he's in the midst of a very busy time, and his father's passed away recently. He's talking about, you know, it's on his thoughts. His mother is suddenly at the house alone now. He's also talking about those children you mentioned graduating to college, and his wife is suddenly at the home alone now. Mm. And he's, you know, Paul mentioned the schedule. It's fairly horrific, and said Africa's on the horizon. You just hope it's sustainable for him personally. From a Leinster point of view, because that stuff will play on your mind as you're going back
His kids are gone. So yeah. They'll only too long before they're gone, and his wife will probably come over then, or may.
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And he's not in any way, I don't get any sense from him through any of the interviews that he's thinking about going back.
No. This is not a reaching breaking point interview. But it's a tough old schedule.
Oh, there's no doubt.
Yeah.
I just got the impression from the time that I was speaking to him on that one occasion that he was so open and honest to someone that he'd never met before. Mm. He just comes across as a very honourable, decent human being. That he inevitably will leave Leinster to go on to coach, if he wants to go to super rugby down the Southern Hemisphere, that it'll be well marked, and that they'll have plenty of time to prepare for that. Mm. But Leinster are a little bit of a juggernaut now. They have Felipe Contepome in the coaching staff, as well as Leo and Stuart Lancaster. It's just nice at this moment in time, and hopefully in 2 hours' time, it'll still be nice to be a Leinster fan and following them.
Okay, well, that's worth checking out in whichever paper you do. And then,
what's the budget there? The budget must be phenomenal.
Well, I think an awful lot of the players are on central contracts, so that's through the IRFU.
The coaching budget?
I have no idea.
I don't know what the exact budget is. I mean, they're certainly funded to the same extent as the other provinces, but their facilities are world class. They obviously have an ability to raise money to pay for things.
Right.
It certainly helps being in the capital city, I would think.
Aye.
Neil Francis touches on the final rugby piece, the Cipriani head-high tackle yesterday at Thomond Park. Tough on Cipriani, but head-high tackle policy has to be enforced, is his point. He essentially makes the argument that world rugby may actually buck the trend, in that every organisation everywhere talks about putting player welfare at the forefront and then often doesn't do it. So he's talking about how this is going to be frustrating in the short term, where Cipriani's shoulder went into the head of Rory Scannell. He didn't hit him the way Kaino did last week. He almost tried to avoid the tackle, but still he got his red card. It pretty much ruined the game. And Frano says, it may be frustrating in the short term, but I think we'll get there. Most concussions come in the tackle, and the majority of these concussions come from head-eye tackles and head-to-head contact.
Sorry, Joe, just an important... He also says why they've done it, why World Rugby are doing it.
Three words, CTE, class action.
There you go.
Yeah, is his point.
Yeah, so the Frano, as usual, starts his piece with a lovely hooker. That's just a phrase to get you started. About never seeing a statue erected in commemoration of a committee, but in this occasion, it seems that the Committee for World Rugby have got it right. But he goes into the point that yes, Cipriani was sent off, but they could have easily have lost a second player for another head high tackle, and if Cipriani wasn't off, that player would have went off as well. So they are changing it. Yeah.
Twelvetrees should have walked, but then he says the game would have descended into a farce, and the Gloucester centre only got the sanction of a penalty. Consistency is always the first casualty of the zero tolerance policy.
Yeah, and he's absolutely right. And fans of Gloucester, when you see that happen to a team that you've invested in coming across Limerick for what you hope would be a great game of rugby, and it's all over at that stage, it's just it's heartbreaking, and you'd feel hard done by doing that, and that the referee doesn't have a leniency about him, that he'd say, well, he didn't really mean it, I'm going to leave him on. But the referees have obviously been told that you've got to come down harshly on this, and if they don't, well, then it's never going to stop, and there has to be zero tolerance. And Frano's right, if it was followed to the latter, they should have lost a second player. And I'm sure the Munster supporters wouldn't have minded that either. You know,
Cipriani's reaction was great, wasn't it?
Fantastic.
Because I'm sure he was thinking, oh, come on.
Really fantastic. And it's been an interesting weekend for that, because I get irritated and have been irritated quite a lot over the last year with rugby, and they keep pushing their values on us. And I look at the drugs issue, the painkillers, the abuse of painkillers, the Grobar situation, and I'm wondering where the values are with important issues like that. I take my hat off to a lot of other areas in the game, and in the way the players conduct themselves. And we had a number of examples of that this weekend with Cipriani, who was superb in the way that he didn't argue with the ref, didn't play with the ref. He looked across at, who was the player?
Scannell.
Asked him, was he okay? Walked off. I thought that was absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
And I just want to make a small point, because I just happened to pick up Pat Spillane's column in the Sunday World. And he's talking about, rugby, the darling sport of the Irish. When I watch rugby now, what I mostly see are man monsters crashing into each other with ever increasing frequency. Professional rugby has a serious welfare issue. It's becoming too dangerous to play. And sure, there are issues, and sure, there's all that. But it's also what you don't see in Gaelic games is what we saw yesterday with Cipriani. You know, if that happens in Gaelic games, it'll be a mass brawl. You'll have fellas running off the pitch. You'll have managers screaming at the mic, trying to get the ref. It's just a disgrace. Mm. And in soccer, it wouldn't be exactly the same. Rugby has set the standard for how to behave on a pitch. And they should be applauded for it. The other example, obviously, was last night and Simon Zeebo and the game against Ulster. Did you watch that?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
And?
Well, I was kind of torn between, who to support, not because...
No, take your supporters' hat off. Take your supporters' hat off and behave like a pundit now.
Okay, so right. So I'm looking
you're
at this...
You're not a Leinster fan now, right?
So are you talking about Owens pulling Zeebo back and saying, go over there and apologise to him?
The whole thing.
Yeah, well, I thought... This is why Simon Zeebo will never benefit from a Johnny Sexton-type card from Joe Schmidt, the Sexton clause that he's gone away, he's forgotten, he's done. And this is why. And he does himself no favours by behaving like this.
Go on.
Okay. So the finger in the face as he goes over to score his try, that disgusts me. I don't like it.
It's a strong word, disgust.
Yeah.
All right, go on, keep going.
I presume his subsequent reaction doesn't disgust you.
No, but he shouldn't have to do that, And I think that when you go to an environment that allows that kind of behaviour and your teammates tolerate it, and this kind of chest bumping with Freddie Thoma after try scoring and prowling like peacocks in the goal scoring area, you would never see. And let's say an Ulster player doing that. Never, ever, no matter what was going on. But these French people, or French teams, seem to tolerate it. And Simon has fitted in nicely with that. But it doesn't fit in with my idea of how to play rugby and how rugby should be played. Him hanging around for 10 minutes outside the changing rooms to give him his jersey and to apologise again, that's that is class.
Yeah.
But
and he tweeted
does that
again.
Make, yes. I mean, does that make up for what he did?
I think it does. I think it's a spur of the moment silly thing. I don't think he routinely points in an opponent's face as he's going over the try line. Celebrations, I think, they're entitled to celebrate a little bit. Joe Schmidt doesn't like it. I appreciate you may not like it. Yeah. I think it's fair enough to celebrate when you've scored a try. The only problem I had was the wagging in the finger before the celebration. I take your point about the peacock thing. It's not everyone's cup of tea, but that wouldn't disgust me.
The Burns issue last week, you know, where Burns gets criticised by showboating before he touches down,
yes.
And then he fails to touch down, and then they go on to lose the game. And yet you have Simon Szebo doing the same thing the following week.
It was a bad move.
What are you doing,
let's be clear on one thing. The reason that Simon Szebo will not be afforded the same latitude as Johnny Sexton was during his time at Racing has nothing whatsoever to do with him wagging his finger. It is that Johnny Sexton is indispensable to the team, and he has a number of options at fullback. So that's number one for a start.
Well, I disagree. No, I think it's a whole package thing. I think that that behaviour before he scored his try just gives people like me ammunition to fire back at Simon Szebo. And his behaviour afterwards, yes. You know, he comes back and he does something really nice, and he makes it up to the guy who's only 20.
I know, he picked the wrong guy to do it. Yeah, would you accept? Szebo had sort of made the point that it was a very emotional week for him, a big week for him. He was playing effectively in front of an Irish audience. He knew Joe Schmidt would be watching. He was wound up for that game. World Cup on the horizon. Wants to prove his point. He's scoring a try, really good performance, and just in heat of the moment did something silly, which we can all do. And then he owned his action afterwards.
No, I don't accept it at all. And he was run over for one of the Ulster tries as well.
Yeah.
And no Ulster player went over to him and wagged their finger at him, you know, hey boy, get back up.
I'm not saying it was right. I'm just saying it can happen.
No, it just shouldn't happen. It's the same zero tolerance that I would apply. I want to say now, before the Munster supporters who still love Simon get on my case, that what he did afterwards was an act of pure class, but we all know about it. Do you understand what I mean there?
Sure.
Okay. We all know about it because he's told us how classy he was afterwards. You know, that's not pure class.
That's a little bit unfair.
No.
So, but I didn't, you watched the game live,
yes.
Did you? I didn't. I don't have BT Sport. Pain in the arse now. You've got to have so many subscriptions, and so I wanted to watch the game.
Sure.
And I was in Paris at the Ryder Cup, and I was actually during my time there reading L'Équipe, and it was really interesting how well Szebo was doing over there. I mean, is he the leading try scorer?
He's scored in every game or something
That's really, fair. You've got to tip your hat to him. Not an easy place thing to do. Go away to a big country like a big rugby country, and to perform to that level is super. Now I heard about the kerfuffle on Twitter and I looked at it. I saw, I wondered what he'd done first. He'd issued an apology. That sounds pretty serious now. He used to go issuing apologies. What has he done? And then they showed a clip of him, and I'm still not sure after, well, hold on, he seems to have his finger out. Is he wagging? What's he? So now it transpires. This is what it's about. He's gone, he's wagged his finger as he's running over. I don't like that. I really don't like it. I didn't like the swan dive. I don't like any of that shite. I think it's wrong. I don't think it has a place in sport. And I think it's good that he's addressed it himself.
Hmm.
I think it was insulting to...
Larry.
Yeah, I think it was insulting to Larry. But I think he addressed that himself.
I think genuinely too.
I think he was
I know you're making the PR point, but I think he genuinely thought...
I accept Gary's point that it's in his nature. It seems to be in his nature to be flamboyant and to showboat a bit.
Yeah.
I think he can learn from that. I think there's a line there, and it's a narrow line. You've got to be you should be careful.
Do you think someone at that stage in their career should be still learning those kind of things?
Well, I'm still learning. I'm 50. I'm 56.
But that's not
in
about
every aspect of my life.
This kind of professional behavior. That's completely different. I disagree. Those lessons are learned at schoolboy, at under 19, at under 20 level, and they're drilled into you. And I think this is, in essence, why Simon Szebo just didn't fit in well, because he has this X factor that doesn't conform to the strictly regulated way and that's what I like.
No,
I'd make no apologies.
You like
for
that, and you're
that.
Drawn to that, and maybe that's how you do your best, and that fits into your how you see things. I remember Ronan O'Gara talking about when Zeebo first came along at Munster. And he was looking at him in the gym and he's cracking jokes and he's standing around and he's messing around. And Roger's seething across the room in a Gary O'Toole-esque kind of way, thinking, what is this? We're here to work. And it took him a while to realise, well, Zeebo is working, actually. He just needs to have fun. He needs to exude. He needs to interact with people. He maybe needs to do, you know, showboat and enjoy himself to be his best. That was the key point. For him to be his best, he needs to. Now, can you overstep the line? Yes. I mean, did he get into Larry's face afterwards and give it the Johnny Sexton down to Ronan O'Gara?
Yeah, okay.
Okay, glass houses. Did he do that? No, he didn't. Yeah. Did Sexton apologise to O'Gara immediately? No, he didn't. Mm. So.
Well, not that we know of.
But it, certainly not publicly. Certainly didn't come out afterwards and go, oh, sorry, silly. Not well, straight
away. It was a different environment.
No, but I'm searching for parallels here.
No, you've done well there.
It's a different environment in terms of social media when that all happened, kicked off in 2009.
Just take a Leinster cup off. That's
sure, but if you remember, he went over to, Zeebo went over to Larry straight away on the pitch as well.
Sure.
Okay, so
I fully accept that.
Right. Yes.
Okay, we all make mistakes. What else have we got?
Well, the theme of showboring is the theme of Eamon Sweeney's column in the back page at the end of the Independent today, and it's interesting because again, extremely well written, and he comes up with a number of examples of. That we shouldn't really be surprised by this.
Showboating wasn't born with this generation, this kind of theme.
Yeah. I think certainly in rugby, the swan dive was the start of it. And what do you call him? Ashton.
Yeah, who did it again yesterday.
Did he? Oh my God.
Has he ever botched one? I was trying to think after the Freddie Burns thing. Has the
thought
swan?
He did, I think thought he did botch one. Thought he botched one.
I don't know, but he scored a hat-trick yesterday and
he's still doing
dived over nicely for the third one. Yeah.
Well, his career, I think, was definitely suffered for that, hasn't it?
Well, he's just come back from a ban. He was out for 7 weeks, so yesterday was his first game back. And you have to hand it to him. He doesn't know how to finish with aplomb. He wouldn't be taught down in the backfields of Donnybrook now with the under 8s and under 10s.
Yeah, I actually, what was I listening to? I did see last week. What was the game on last week?
The rugby.
Yeah.
The Bat to Lose one, the Freddie Burns.
Yeah, the Bat to Lose one, yeah.
Freddie Burns.
What station was that on?
It was on Virgin Media 1.
Okay, I did watch that. And no, it couldn't have been watched because it was O'Driscoll. I heard O'Driscoll.
BT then.
I heard O'Driscoll react. Oh no, I was away. That's why. And I was away, and where I was had bad BT. So I watched the, and it was interesting, the reaction of O'Driscoll to it, because he was getting a lot of sympathy on Twitter. Burns was getting a lot of ex-players about, oh, well, you know, God help me, I really regret this.
Yeah.
And O'Driscoll was having none of it. And you knew from O'Driscoll's tone, this is like, what a aegis.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
I thought it was great.
Shane Jennings was of a similar opinion.
Yeah, actually. I thought it was, I thought it was great.
You think it's great that former players give an opinion straight down the middle, or do you think it's great that
obviously they give an opinion, yeah, that they weren't going with the, you know, well, poor Freddie, you know, he's a great lad, you know.
Sweeney obviously charts decades of showboating and picking up bits. Do we have any issues in the world of cycling with lads spreading their arms before the line? Do we have swimmers over celebrating?
We've had that loads of times.
Right.
We've had that loads of times. Slightly different in the sense that it's not a team sport, so you will pay the penalty. If you mess up like that, you're the guy who's going to suffer. You know, you're going to pay the price for it. It's never happened to me. I totally understand the buzz you get from winning. It's so spontaneous and you really want to celebrate. And it has happened that it's particularly the sprinters that they've been cut out. They've thrown their hands up too early and someone has nipped by. Mm. So it does happen. Mm. But it's slightly different.
It's not
than
a frowned upon thing.
It's of course it's frowned upon if you lose.
Yeah.
If you lose. Yeah. And you shouldn't do it again. And as I said, it didn't happen to me. But it does happen, and again, because it's not a team sport, you pay the price for it. But I like Damon's piece because he reminded us again. You made the point that this is not something that's happened overnight, and he goes back to Ovette in the '80s. I didn't realise that Tracy had actually caught Ovette. Ovette had the old finger out.
Yeah, no idea.
I thought he would mention actually. Eamon would mention the one that does stick out was Eamon Coughlin when he won. Was it 5,000?
In the World Championships. In Helsinki in 83,
You were probably even born then, were you?
Yeah.
When?
83.
No.
So, You know who M. Coughlin is? Ever heard of M. Coughlin?
The thing is, I'm not especially young anymore. You two are just becoming very old.
Okay. So he was passing Dmitry Dmitriev with about 100 meters to go. Mm. And he knew that Dmitriev was going backwards and he was going to win this. And he gave it the two fists. As he was going by him.
And he looked at him.
And he did look at him and he went on. And he
got a bit of flack for that at the time as well, didn't he? I think he did.
Well, you've got me in kind of a Johnny Sexton, Eamon Coughlin kind of realm here that I couldn't criticise him. You know, he's heartbroken in 76, heartbroken in 80, you know.
So there was a context to it.
And then when you know the backstory, I'm sure if you were Dmitriev's wife or coach, you'd be looking at Coughlin going, oh my God. And you'd be just as vitriolic as I am being about Simon Szabo.
Yeah.
And there, if you understand, and I suppose, you know, you have to have all the facts before you condemn someone, is the thing. But so Eamon doing that, he was showboating, but he won. That's the difference. I mean, that's why he doesn't make Eamon's piece. He won.
Well, I think Szabo was showboating and he scored a try as well.
And they won. Would you leave me alone about Simon Szabo, please?
So there's a great example. So he quotes Eamon quotes the Szabo Vet one just after he'd won an Olympic medal. He was in Crystal Palace and actually John Tracy pipped him on the line after he'd done this. But I really love the example he used. It's a really cruel example. An American footballer called Leon Less of the Dallas Cowboys. And this guy, 1983 in the Super Bowl, he'd recovered a fumble by the Buffalo Bills. I'm going to quote from it now. And gone 60 plus yards towards the end zone when he slowed down and held the ball theatrically out in front of him. He admitted later that he was watching himself on the stadium's big screen and trying to emulate a touchdown move by his teammate Michael Irvin. It would, said Letts, have been his first touchdown, right? Since I was 10 years old playing peewee football. And the cruelty of it is he never did score a touchdown.
No. And he was about to score in the Super Bowl, which...
I mean, that is cruel.
Well, American football is very cruel. I remember reading a retirement, and forgive me, the name doesn't spring to mind, a retirement tribute piece to an American footballer 2 years ago. And he was a five-time All-Star. He had maybe one or two Super Bowls to his name. So he's very well high-achieving guy amongst football. And they said, what's your one regret? And he said, well, my one regret is I never touched the football. Yeah. So he'd never touched the football in his career as part of the game.
That's astonishing.
And how can you be a footballer never having touched and to achieve such greatness?
That's astonishing.
So American football is is a strange, strange sport. But the jockey that celebrated 100 yards from the line on his horse, that's the classic
and
one.
And they made the point he's had 200 winners since, but still, if you say his name,
yes,
that's the first thing. Like Freddie Burns could win the World Cup.
Yeah, well, he says
all
that.
Freddie Burns for one thing.
He says that. Yeah, that's how he concludes the piece here. You know, in a few years' time, no one will remember anything about that bat to lose game except the mistake at the end. It will become Freddie Burns' trademark. Some company may even sign him up for an ad campaign with the slogan, "It's all a matter of timing," or the like. Instead of merely scoring a try, Freddie Burns gave us something that will be a joy forever. I don't take much joy from it, I've got to say. Even the rewinds, the replays on social media, I don't really take any joy from it. I just think, oh, Jesus.
Well, I suppose when you're watching it with a neutral hat on, you just go, "Oh, that's a terrible mistake." If you were watching it and it was your team that had knocked it out of his hand, you'd be absolutely euphoric about the whole thing. But I mean, there's a Pizza Hut ad in the future for him as well.
Well, that's true. We'll get on to Joe Brawley in a moment. Inhumane Business, designed to bring out worse in us. So he's written a follow-up piece to his UFC MMA piece last week. But beneath that, really interesting. Brian Cody has made a bit of an intervention here. People will be interested in these quotes. Cody, club players are isolated, county players are being slaughtered. And he says, the bottom line is that club pitches are empty during the summer. That, he says, Brian Cody talking to John Green here, is dangerous territory for the GAA. Two elements to it, inter-county and club. There has to be a meeting of minds. There has to be a coming together. The majority of members in the GAA are in the club, so they can't just be told, you stay where we are and we'll get the other lads sorted. He says, I saw where Tommy Walsh said something a while back that in 10 years' time you won't have hurling, you'll have elite hurling. And he says, he finishes by piece. John asks him, is he worried? I am worried. I would say, absolutely, I am worried. Another stage, he says, what's best for everybody? Because he says, I'm not trying to pretend the championship as it was this year wasn't exciting for inter-county, but for the people and for the people watching it, but it only works for a very tiny percentage of GAA people, so it can't or couldn't be the right thing.
Well, he doesn't say much, Brian. So when he does say something, it's interesting.
Yeah.
He's got something to say here, and he's worth listening to. What I found interesting about it is that, you know, Brian Cody's reputation, if you want, is built upon the fact that he is an inter-county manager and a hugely successful one. So, you know, for him to say what he's saying here, given the season that we've just had and given the magic of the Hurling Championship, is really important because he acknowledges that it was great, but he's just saying it's not sustainable. You know, you cannot keep making these demands of players and expect that, you know, we're going to have the game that we've had for so long. You know, he said the key quote, to me, it goes against everything we're supposed to be about. And I just think if it continues to go like this, we're going to have a real divide, a real disconnect, a real sense of we don't really matter. We're just second class citizens.
Yeah, no, it's they're big quotes. I'm sure they'll get a bit of reaction. And actually, similar theme. Michael Dignan was touching in the Mail on the price of tickets, especially for students, and saying, like, why are we charging X amount for students? Like, it should be nothing for students. The GA doesn't need to make this kind of money. So this theme just rumbles on.
And the theme is, and you've used the word there, the theme is money. Everything is money-driven, money-oriented professionalism, and that's a cancer that will ultimately kill your sport.
Mm. So Joe Brawley wrote last week...
No, let's not go, Brawley, please. A bit later.
A bit later.
Because there are far more, far better pieces, not just in this section, but in the other section. Make a small point about that. So you're going to go to Joe Brawley and you're going to say, yeah, blah, blah, blah. This is exactly what he said last week. I read that. I thought it was brilliantly written. Mm. I thought he made some very good points. Now, I don't want to read it again. Now, if you want to talk about it again, that's fine.
Well, I'll touch on it because people might have wondered, did he follow up on it or did he write about it again?
What's to follow up on? What is to follow up on with this? He's made the arguments. He made this, for me, I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, okay, well, he made an argument last week and now he's going to say, I was right. Look, this is why I was right. Hey, people, look how right I was. I mean, what is the point? Let's have a different view from some of the people he's holding to account.
Mm-hmm. To be fair, I'm sure the Independent did look for a different view. If not, John Green should go out and try and find someone, Coach Kavanagh or one of the other people that are tweeting so viciously against Joe Brawley during the week. These small little quips and tweets, they hold no water in comparison to Joe's, brief that he writes.
That is exactly the point.
Yeah, but you can't. You're not comparing like with like. And I'd just like to say something on the Joe Brawley piece. I know you don't want to talk about it. And off the Joe Brawley piece. After reading the Joe Brawley piece this week, I was wondering, why are people fascinated with MMA? Why do they like it? And what has happened to make it so disgusting to some people that previously were interested in it? And I think that I was reminded of a time when I was going through the airport when Katie Taylor was fighting for her gold medal in London. And we were stopped in Dublin Airport in the terminal. And there was about 60 people gathered around the TV screen. And Katie was boxing that Russian girl. And at the end of the first round, there was silence because nobody knew who was ahead, right? So then all of a sudden it comes up that it's 10-9 to Katie Taylor and everyone starts to cheer. And then the second round, it was the same again, silence, because nobody knew who was ahead either. And what MMA has taken out of it, it's taken out for the spectator, it's taken out that enduring ignorance during a competitive fight, that you know looking at it who is winning this fight. There's none of this skill. You know, Mick Dowling, Michael Carruth, or Kenny Egan can be in the studios and they can be looking at this going, oh yeah, Katie has this, she's got this round, she's the better. But in MMA...
I couldn't disagree more.
Yeah, no,
it is a skill. And there are commentators who will look at this and will tell you exactly what is being done. And you've had them on Chris Fields.
Oh, yeah.
He'll sit down, he'll analyse it, he'll tell you exactly what's going on. It's a skillful game. It's a very skillful game.
I've heard Chris, and he's excellent. But my point is that for other punters who don't have that degree of insight that Chris has, they still have an idea who's won that first round. Because when the guy gets up, if he's pulverized, really, yeah. More often than not, Paul, you know, you could watch an amateur boxing match, and I've been to the stadium, watched these amateur boxing matches, and hadn't a clue who was won. And yet the arm is raised aloft and everyone else going, oh, that was quite obvious. I'm saying, to who was it quite obvious? Because to the person who's on the side of the ring, it wasn't quite obvious to me. I couldn't walk in and say, there's Chelsea 2-0 up against.
So what is the point then?
To be fair, you can get MMA fights, UFC fights, where it's two lads grappling on the ground for 5 minutes and it looks like a version of a rugby scrum and you don't know what's happened either. And they're done on points. It can happen.
Yeah, but invariably, you know, what I'm saying is that they don't usually come to this. But what has happened to the MMA is it's lost its direction. It's grown too much, too quickly, and too much money has become
now you're conflicting MMA with UFC. That's the problem with Joe Broglie's piece.
Yeah, okay. So the UFC then has grown too big and it's become a character.
It's become WWE now, more and more WWE.
Well, it's not. The WWE is staged. There's nothing staged about this.
You know, there's a lot.
It has
staged.
Been bought recently by owners who were involved in WWE and it's become a bit more cutthroat.
Yeah, but yeah. Beforehand, yes, this nonsense that was going on.
In the cage, in the octagon, yeah, obviously not.
There's no comparison between the two fights, you know.
There's no one soaking blood capsules.
Ronda Rousey is now, you know, doing great in professional wrestling, and she's bought into that theatre. But what MMA was doing for people was it was allowing them to understand what was going on, and now it's become blurred again. And that's my feeling on MMA. And previously, it was about discipline.
That's your feeling on UFC.
UFC. The MMA, the gyms that have opened up around Dublin are all about discipline. They're all about coming in, getting off the street, working hard, training hard. And that is
a good thing?
That is an excellent thing.
Absolutely.
That is something to be
instilled.
So
there's more to this than blood and guts and the points that Broglie's making.
But that's what John Cavan is getting mixed up about as well. You know, John is doing great things for huge amount of the youth where his gym and the other gyms out in Tala cover, and they're to be commended for that. They're not. I wouldn't say that they're to be, you know, condemned in the same way as the UFC.
You made the point about other voices wanting to be heard about this, and you muse John Kavanagh, and you're talking to someone who's actively engaged with John Kavanagh in doing that at the moment.
Okay, good.
And I totally accept what you're saying.
Right. So next week, might be someone else sitting down here and saying, well, here it is.
To round it off then, not a huge amount of new in it, but he does say interestingly at the end that he's been sounding out some TDs and senators in the last week, universally appalled by what's become normal. I intend to set up a working group to look into the banning.
Who's this? Shane Ross again? Oh, give me a break. Listen, I'll tell you what, let me ask Joe Broglie, did he read John Kavanagh's book? And was he appalled by the violence and the thuggery that went on that John Kavanagh was subjected to? It was absolutely disgraceful. Mm. Absolutely disgraceful what Kavanagh was subjected to. And I could have missed it. Did Broglie write a piece about that?
I'm sure over the years he's condemned that sort of stuff, in fairness to him. What I'm interested in actually is, where do you draw the line? So Kieran Cunningham made a point last week that there are more deaths in boxing, for instance. So I understand people are horrified by UFC or even MMA, the more vicious fights in MMA. Mm. The two can both be vicious.
But even more people die on the golf course or more injuries from stray balls on the golf course. You know,
totally. So I do wonder if you set up a working group and
riders died beside me.
Well, listen, I've no doubt. So where do you draw the line? How is one person's sensibilities for what's acceptable superior to someone, another person's, you know? What if someone says, well, I can't, if you're going to ban MMA, then you have to ban boxing. If you're going to do boxing, I think, you know, well, someone else's rugby has to go, you know, and before you know it, where do you go?
There has to be a degree of respect for your opponent, no matter what sport it's doing.
Two weeks ago,
at that fight in Las Vegas, there was a disrespect for the opponent, and that Conor McGregor is the world's best at getting under people's skin.
But that's not the issue, afterwards,
he is always very respectful.
Yeah, he is actually. Okay. So that's pantomime. That's not actually the sport.
But
and
that's not what came across last week.
No,
at
sure.
All.
But you have to take a bigger sample size than just one grotesque situation. We're talking about the big sport here.
This was their big showcase event, you know? And then the guy that won it was the exact opposite to the way that McGregor would have acted if he won. And I would say that, not being a huge fan of McGregor's, but giving him credit where credit is due. And,
One night is too small a sample size. And actually, the stuff, the outside the octagon stuff, is not actually what Bradley was writing about last week. I mean, he's writing about it more this week.
Sure.
It's the sport itself, which, you know, he's talking about, as opposed to all the circus.
Okay.
And I don't know where you draw a line on.
Well, that's the line, that's the UFC MMA
again,
line.
Sean Kavanagh, 16 years old, walking off a pitch, some fella runs up and smacks him in the side of the head. Mm. You know.
Yeah.
That's great.
It never happened in swimming. Never. Never.
We'll take a short break and then we'll get to some more stories in just a moment.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
Thanks to Screwfix.ie. Championing the trade with a choice of over 20,000 quality trade products.
Welcome back, Gary O'Toole, Paul Kimmage in studio. Kieran O'Reilly tweets in, Gary must have quite the love-hate relationship with American football if Sebo's relatively mild celebrations disgust him. It's an interesting point.
Well, the American football that I follow, the college football, post-touchdown celebrations are banned. And if you score a touchdown in American college football and you celebrate it, you will be suspended. So it's very easy. There's a zero tolerance with that. So I am completely comfortable with my love of American college football. Do I follow American professional football? Not to the same extent.
Right.
Not to the same extent. And can I say, I didn't mean to be vicious on Simon Zeebo.
You smiled there when you said not to the same extent.
I follow every sport.
You actually love American pro football.
You're celebrating as much as they are. In fairness to you, because it can be difficult in live radio, the first thing you said there when we went to the ad break was, God, I feel I was too harsh on Zeebo.
And I think I'd like to apologise. And I would like to say sorry to all those people who are offended by my remarks about Zeebo. I did say what he did was class. Well, if Simon is listening, I'm very sorry, Simon. But he recognises the fact that what he did was wrong. I'm just saying that what he did was wrong. Hmm. But what he did afterwards was an act of class, and I think I recognise that.
Good. Interestingly, the trajectory of your situation here is exactly the same as Zeebo's. Made a mistake, and then realised it, and just apologised, and let everyone know that you'd apologise as well.
I think Zeebo was more sincere, actually.
Yeah.
I want you to say,
I want Simon Zeebo back in the Ireland team in front of Rob Kearney and Jordan Larmour.
No, I would never say
that. I want you to say that.
No, I just couldn't say that.
Well, okay.
I couldn't say that.
I don't think that he's
a better player than Jordan Larmour or Rob Kearney.
Okay.
Somebody tweeted me to point out that WWE did not buy the UFC, and they are correct. WME/IMG bought it. But I still stand by the point that it's definitely become, they've ramped it up since they bought it for $4 billion because they need to make the $4 billion back. But I'm happy to clarify that point. Where do you want to go next? We have Robert Huth, we have Tommy Conlon, you liked, we have Tim Rice, we have a few different bits. I feel like Gary's getting a good kick in this news round and should be allowed to pick.
Deservedly.
Let's go to Tommy Conlon's piece on the Brian O'Driscoll documentary. And
which I should say I haven't seen. I don't think Paul has seen either. You have seen.
I flagged this.
You flagged what?
The Tommy Conlon piece.
You let Gary have anything.
I'm pulling you on something deliberate.
I'm saying that the documentary, not the Tommy Conlon piece.
Sorry.
Have you watched that?
Joe, I'm really sorry. I misunderstood.
Well, that's not good enough for Gary.
Okay.
Right, so we haven't seen the documentary.
I have seen the documentary. It was excellent, very well produced. And Craig Doyle, who works with Brian, produced it with Sally Brown. Excellent.
Stop now.
Very well done. But what struck me about the documentary was that me now looking back at O'Driscoll's dilemma when he was captain of Ireland and interviewing Rory Best as now captain of Ireland was the naivety that sportsmen sometimes approach their sport with. And this is from an Irish swimmer that swam on an Irish team with an acting RUC officer and was away on an Irish trip during the 12th of July celebrations and didn't really understand why he was so happy that day that he was not on duty for the RUC.
What did he say he would have been doing?
He would have been stuck in one of those, Land Rovers, the Land Rovers, you know, policing the divide between Catholics and Protestants, taking Molotov cocktails to the front of the vehicle, and reversing or driving forward as was appropriate. It was just as awful as it was made out on the documentary. Mm. And when you realize that and you say that people who I would have been, you know, would have had a sympathy with the, you know, the Catholics up the north, and he was a Protestant, and you just go, wow, how could you treat someone else like that? And that came across well in the documentary. There were three basic parts to the documentary. There was the troubles that started in 72 and the very powerful interview with Willie John McBride and David Duckham. There was the next part of it was during the 70s, you know, during the 80s, and the last part was the Crow Park thing, which I know you're very young, Joe, but you surely remember Crow Park, right?
That's bad, yeah.
Yes. And it was just fantastically well produced and very emotional, actually. Yeah, it was very emotional.
What was the emotion?
David Duckham was very emotional when he said about the Wales and Scotland not coming over to play in 72, and Willie John McBride picking up the phone and just saying to David, "You must come," and that's all he said. And Duckham hangs up the phone and goes, "Oh my God, we've got to go over there and play for them," and the reception they got in Lansdowne Road, mm-hmm. as it was at the time, and the reception they got at the post-match dinner really struck a chord, and they brought that out very well in the documentary.
It's interesting, actually. Our Celtic brothers didn't come in 72, and then you fast forward to very recently, and there was the voting for who'd host the World Cup, and
they've
our Celtic
never
brothers
failed to let us down.
Let us down again, never and it was failed. England who voted for Ireland to host the World Cup.
Exactly.
Very
honourable, and hats off to them. But the
England,
England. The explosion where Judge Morris Gibson and his wife Cecily were killed in the explosion at the time when the three rugby players were coming down to engage in a training session for the Irish team, Nigel Carr, David Irwin and Philip Rainey.
Yeah. This was in 87.
That was dealt with extremely well, and Brian was in the spot where the explosion went off. Now, I'm not saying that the IRFU were responsible. You know, they weren't as responsible for the Good Friday Agreement as Bertie Ahern and Tony Blair.
Can I stop you? I just want to ask you something. You said something really interesting right at the start. I'm really interested that you should develop. And that's in O'Driscoll's part in this, and his naivety with regard to playing with Best.
Yes.
And what he discovered, yeah.
I got the impression. I got the impression from Brian talking to Rory that they'd never sat down and had this talk.
Yeah.
When Brian was the captain of Ireland and Rory was playing for Ireland, and Brian had never engaged with any Northern or Ulster players that had come down.
How many Southern people do that, have that conversation? And how many of us understand what it was like, what it is like to live up there?
I don't think we could have done during the troubles, right? But Brian was captain of Ireland after the troubles as well. I was swimming with an RUC officer during the troubles.
Yeah.
And were it not for the fact that he was so elated at one day on the 12th of July and he was skipping into lunch saying, you know, you guess where I would be today, it hadn't struck me that it was the 12th of July.
Did you swim up there?
Oh, yes.
During the troubles.
Oh, my God, did I swim up there. I hated it. I hated going up there. I hated I just felt uncomfortable up there. And they were always more than welcoming. And, you know, always. But I always got the impression that I was a foreigner. So they used to have the Irish Nationals up in Belfast. They could play.
You got that sense, did you?
Yeah, play God Save the Queen before the Irish Nationals up in Belfast. And we'd come and compete for the Irish National title. And, you know, it sounds terrible, but I never was comfortable.
That's really interesting and an absolute contrast to my experiences there. So we were at the Open up in Donegal this year, and I drove through the north to get there, and I stopped off in a little small town called Market Hill, which is not too far outside Newry. And I stopped off in Market Hill to have a look around, because in 1962, the year I was born, my father won the Irish National Road Race Championships in Market Hill. And I stopped there during the summer, and even to this day, I was astonished by the amount of the Union Jacks everywhere.
Mm.
I mean, this is only like 20 minutes out of Newry, and you go into this place, Market Hill, and just Union Jacks everywhere.
Mm.
And I just kind of thought, well, Jesus, what must that have been like back in 62 when my dad was racing up here? Now, I had that experience as well during the worst of the troubles. We went up regularly to Belfast, to Banbridge, and raced in the north. There were Galway's great roads, much better roads than, and it's actually the inverse now, that we've better roads down here than they had there, but Galway's great roads, great racers, great bike riders, but I always felt more, you know, incredibly welcomed by the guys I was racing with. I mean, you know, I knew some of them were RUC officers. Never any sense, actually an appreciation, that we were going up there and we were racing. New guys who had been locked up for as nationalists, Republicans, again both sides, and it was these guys were racing with each other, and there was never any sense when they were racing, when we were competing, of that feeling that you got, you know, that you weren't. It was the complete opposite. Mm.
But you're saying you got it from the atmosphere as opposed to the fellow swimmers, from the swimmers?
Oh no, not at all.
So that's interesting that your experience and O'Driscoll's and the rugby experience is swimmers, that when sport is there.
There was a threat, you were always really, I mean, there was always a sigh of relief when you came back across the border. I mean, Jez, you did not know whether you were going to get stopped. We came back at all hours of the night from races and, you know, when you got across the border, it was like, oh, Jesus. Thank God for that.
And did you talk about it?
Oh, we did, absolutely. I mean, I remember you mentioned the 12th of July. We were up there, we were racing up in, I think, Newton Erds, and I was with Dave Kane, who was a great biker at the time, who raced with my father. I remember Dave actually telling us, look, there could be trouble here. You need to go home that way, you know, to get around it, you know, and warning us. So it was always, there was always a threat there. Mm. But from the cycling community, absolutely not. It was just, you were really made welcome, and they were fantastic guys.
You were just sports people. But when Brian went up there, the absolute shock in his face when he saw, or when people were explaining to him, people were taking selfies with him or getting their photo with him. These are guys in the orange sashes and everything else. And Brian was asking them, you know, how do you marry this? You know, you're loyal to the Queen, you're a unionist.
Yeah.
But
how do you feel about Ireland's call?
How do I feel about Ireland's call? Well,
see, from my experiences, I've asked you how, I'm going to tell you how I feel. From my experiences of that, racing up that, Ireland's call has never bothered me. I think, wow, isn't it great that we're playing together? That's a small price to pay for that. Mm. I've always understood the sensitivities of that. And I've always said, well, I take my hat off to those guys. Yeah, fair play.
I agree with that, yeah.
And I do. And the Ireland's call.
A lot of guys down here, don't they go crazy?
I don't think they're thinking it through. Yeah. I think it's easy to dismiss it and say, oh, it's crap. And I know what they mean.
It comes down to the point about how many of us up here actually understand.
Well, isn't there a shocking statistic? I think, I mean, we're into the millions who haven't actually ever stayed a night up north still.
Yes.
In the south, millions. Really? Yeah,
I heard you mention that before. But the thing about Brian's documentary, and I heard him talk about the background behind it, and it was something to do with his mum sitting down, and Brian wasn't singing Ireland's Call. So he would sing the Irish National Anthem, and he was captain. And then when the Ireland's call came on, Brian was standing there and wasn't even mouthing the words. And his mum sat him down.
I don't think that's in his autobiography, is it?
But no, he mentioned on the radio. I don't know, maybe with you guys.
It better have been. It's an exclusive agreement, Gary. Yeah.
So, and then his mum sat him down. They had a discussion about it. And she said, you are captain of all of Ireland.
Yeah.
You must sing the song. So he changed his tune. But what gets me sometimes is that it's not consistent, you know, the bailing out of the national anthem or the singing of the national anthem in the Aviva Stadium is fine, and then it turns to Ireland's call, and on occasion there are still people who won't sing Ireland's call. I have seats in the stadium. There are people beside me who still won't sing Ireland's call, and I sing it. Yeah. But I think it is important, but still, you know, the two national anthems. I always feel a little bit embarrassed for the team that come here to Ireland to have to listen to two anthems. You know, they go to break up after the national anthem, and then the band strikes up again, and they have to huddle back in together. I only want to hear. But anyway, I just think that the Tommy's piece. You know, yes, rugby were great, but they weren't the only sport, as you have just proven, as swimming was as well.
And to mention, Neil O'Riordan in The Sun has written that as well. He's had a look at the documentary and has made that point that you know we can overstate things a little bit maybe.
Not today.
Yeah.
Oh, I missed that.
Yeah. So he's written
overstate
that as well.
What
the importance of rugby. Like, it was great and everything, but it wasn't the only sport was cross-border.
Most sports people looked beyond the politics of the situation, or actually didn't actually concern themselves with the politics of the situation. It wasn't because of that they looked at the politics, analysed it and said, no, I'm above that. It was just because they couldn't actually care about the politics.
Yeah.
And I think that's what was striking about the documentary, that at the time, didn't really concern Brian.
But it wasn't important. The important thing for Brian and Rory Best was winning the Six Nations, and that was all they were focused on. And that's why.
Yeah.
Like, it's interesting, you said that, you know, it wasn't an issue with your fellow swimmers, wasn't an issue for your fellow cyclists, because you were working towards what was far more important to you guys, which was your sport. You know?
Well, see, we were into individual sports.
No, sure.
You know, it's a little bit different.
That's a fair point.
It's a team sport Brian is engaged in.
He raced for Ireland, though.
I raced for Ireland with guys who are of the...
Yeah, yeah.
But
at the same time, you know, Rory Best Rory Best could be hoisting people into the air that have completely different beliefs, and it's just not an issue.
So this has been a wheeling discussion. What are we saying here? What's our takeaway points from the O'Driscoll documentary and the Conlon piece?
Okay. I really enjoyed the documentary, since I'm the only one here that has watched it. And the point that Tommy makes is, it's well done, but there is more to it. It was every single sport as far as...
I would slightly disagree with that. I want to, first of all, pay tribute to Tommy Conlon, okay? I want to pay tribute to him because his column doesn't scream at you. It's across the top of a paper, of a page every week. This is the best piece of writing in any paper this Sunday in sport. This column. Absolutely superb. Let's start with opening paragraph. Yeah. When BOD strapped on a gargantuan lambeg drum at the Orange Order Parade in Loch Hall last July 12th, all you could see of him was his head poking out above and his shoes sticking out below while he banged away in it with the rhythm of a dancing Theresa May. Isn't that just superb? Mm. Larry Mullen's job with U2 is safe for another while. So, you know, what a brilliant way to start. And I know I'm deconstructing it in a way that you wouldn't, but as a writer, I do this. So the point we're getting to here is about the IRFU and the GAA and the IRFU. He makes three very interesting points about how the governing bodies had dealt with it. The IRFU stood resolutely above the sectarian fray, while the GAA, that other All-Ireland institution, was irretrievably locked into its alliance with Catholicism and nationalism by dint of its long-standing policies, practices and cultures. Great point. The Irish Football Association in Northern Ireland was really the loyalist FA, a pillar of the ruling infrastructure that was rigged top to bottom against the Catholic minority. Down south, the FAI was, as usual, too feeble, too blighted by bad governance to take much of a difference one way or the other. So I think that's a really interesting point in that he makes about how the governing bodies actually dealt with this. But also, he's not, you know, this is not a tip of the hat, unqualified tip of that to the RFU. He talks about, well, you know, their gene pool and the kind of background they came from, you know, made that easier.
Yeah, but Neil O'Riordan makes that point as well, actually.
Yeah, made that easier.
It's a similar social class that play the game north and
south. But the bottom one...
And he argued, like, O'Driscoll and Best, given that they probably went to, you know, decent schools and probably had more in common in more ways than they might have with people next door to them.
Which is...
That's an interesting point. Yeah.
Well, I would
disagree with that.
I would say that Brian didn't go to a decent school at all. But that's I'll leave my prejudices aside. I've got into trouble now because of my prejudices, and I was doing so well before that. Sorry,
Bob.
But I think he it's very concisely written. It's brilliantly written, and again he concludes with O'Driscoll leaving. O'Driscoll left Loch Hall on July 12th, a somewhat confused man, and this is kind of going back to the point you made earlier. He'd been hanging out with hardcore unionists, all of whom consider themselves British and some of whom are rugby fans. Quote, but yet they'll come down to Lansdowne Road, particularly against England, and they'll want to win that game the most. There seems at times that there's no commonality. They don't even have a commonality of what it means to be Irish. But in the stands, they're willing to accept that for Irish rugby, we're a whole country, even for the few hours on a Saturday afternoon. That fills me with a huge sense of pride. And Tommy concludes, as indeed it should. I would wonder about the commonality. I think there is a commonality there. I think it's not just the fact that we're playing England, that we can all, you know,
Oh no, it's there. No, I think there's a lot playing more. Any team.
It's a great column, a really great column.
But they're Ulster are massive contributors to the Irish team. The Ulster players that make the Irish team tend to be, you know, super players. You know, they tend to be, you know, Ulster have every reason to be proud of these guys that they push into the Irish team, and the Irish team are extremely lucky to have them. So it's a two-way street, but it always has been that way. It's just the way it is. But when Brian in the documentary, which neither of you have seen and I have seen, and
it's the fourth time you've said that.
Make you a better person.
So when he goes onto his Twitter feed, because someone took a picture and immediately put it up on Twitter of him playing the drum.
Yeah.
When he goes into his Twitter feed, and the amount of abuse he was getting on his Twitter feed, horrendous stuff from people. So the vitriol is still out there, and there are still people who will take to Twitter and just hide behind Twitter. And you just go, oh my God, what do you do?
Yeah. Before we go, Robert Huth in the Sunday Times is one of those pieces that you could flick by and miss. But actually, it turns out Robert Huth, if you haven't heard much from him over the years, is a brilliant character, really interesting on the whole host of things. And he was with Jonathan Northcroft, wasn't it? Page 9 of the Sunday Times. So, well, I said to you, Paul, just before we came in, I thought, God, that Huth thing is worth reading. He's really good. And you agreed, but you agreed it was worth reading only to a point. So your issue with the piece...
No, I don't at all agree that it was worth reading only to a point. My issue with the piece is that it's about what? Is it 1,200 words? And I read it and I thought, my Jesus, this is some interview. What a brilliant piece this would have been if you'd given it some space and some time and some brain power. And, you know, I look at this section and they've got some fantastic journalists. They've got probably the best journalists in the British Isles working for the sports section. And it's like they're in shackles every week because, you know, they're not doing a hell of a lot of great journalism. I don't know how frustrating it must have been for John Norcroft to come back from the interview, but I have a sense of it as he was driving back, knowing that he had this in the can. And that he wasn't going to be given any space to develop it. I think it's absolute, complete sham. You look at it, it's spread across all the way, and then you've got this crap underneath of it. Portuguese men of war, Ronaldo set for uncertain welcome when he faces old boss at Ultra. I mean, who gives a shite about that? You know, here you've got a footballer. We give it all the time about access to footballers. We don't know what they're thinking, we don't know what they're playing. And here you've got someone who has played under Mourinho, who has played with Gareth Southgate at Middlesbrough, who has loads of interesting things to say, loads of observations to make, and who's not afraid to say it, and you give him 1,000 words. I mean, it's a joke, an absolute joke. Look at the last couple of paragraphs alone in terms of how interesting this guy is. He's talking about, you won't even watch Barca Madrid anymore. He says it's shit. 20 guys surrounding the referee, some holding their face, El Clasico off, he says. So you won't watch this because of all the feigning of injury when they're falling down. And this again is coming back to some points we've made earlier. You know, again, another brave thing to say, diving I can understand, you know. There's no difference between diving and me grabbing someone short. You're bending the rules. You know, again, another really interesting. Now you want if you're a journalist, you want to say, Robert, tell me more about that. Develop that. There's no chance to develop this at all. It's just a bloody travesty and a waste.
Yeah, missed opportunity for you.
I think it's just a victim of professional football and the era that we're in now, Paul. That you know, when you do get someone that puts their head above the pulpit, that they just don't get afforded the column inches. I think if he was in Ireland
it's
and he was
to do with professional football, it's to do with the editor of this bloody paper.
No, every other That's professional footballer won't deal with them. And Robert Huth obviously is very comfortable to talk to the journalists. He's retired now, so he's nothing to lose with what he's saying. But I'm absolutely delighted that I've passed the anger hat back to Paul and that I have now. I'm the calming.
Does your point not actually strengthen his, whereby you're saying it's very rare to get these people to open up? So actually, when you do get someone like Huth to open up, and he's talking about, you know, Pulis, there's stuff about Kante, which is really fascinating, John Terry, different people, that when actually that does happen, it's a rarity, you should let it breathe a bit more.
Yeah, but Robert Huth, does he appeal to everyone that's going to pick up the paper?
I know what you mean. Yeah. I can see the name wouldn't have grabbed you, but yeah.
Is he, fair enough, he's won a premiership title and he's experienced all that he's experienced, but he's not a John Terry that's coming out with all
should
of these statements.
Should you trust the reader maybe that he's a good enough name to catch people initially and will come in with a brilliant opener and maybe even highlight a few of his better quotes and people will realise this is actually good?
Sure, but this is a common theme, Paul. The Sunday Times have become this paper that, as you say, you've got the best stable of journalists, but the worst space in which to showcase their talents.
I've obviously got an axe, pretty particular axe in this battle, given I know exactly what's happened here and I was subjected to it myself. And I was reminded of it during the week in a really brilliant column that Lynn Barber did with the Spectator. I don't know if you saw that.
No.
Do you know who Lynn Barber is?
No.
Lynn Barber was, for a long time, the best interviewer in Britain. And she was just, her interviews are just outstanding, a completely different level. She's worked at Vanity Fair, the Sunday Times, she's been everywhere basically. She's worked in the Sunday Times for a few years now. She gets a call from an editor to say, come up and let's have a glass of wine. She goes in, sits down, she's been told, well, you're sacked, we're getting someone else in to do your job, right? She hasn't even looked at her contract, and yeah, they've got the right to sack her after a month. Now, at least she had the grace that she got it was her editor who actually sat her down. She didn't get a call from some asshole in HR she never heard of before, which I did. But anyway, the point she makes is this, and this is what this is really all about. As a journalist, I'm a dinosaur. I like reading words on paper. I like writing long interviews when everybody nowadays wants it short. So this is obviously house policy now, that where we are a newspaper. We are a newspaper, but we're pitching our newspaper towards people who read Twitter every day and who can't actually absorb more than 140 characters. It is bullshit. And she says it in this about her editor. It was hard to deal with an editor, she says, and this is brilliant, who didn't seem to like reading. And that's what we're dealing with here. Mm.
Yeah, the Hood thing is worth checking out, and you'll probably wish it was a bit longer. We're pretty much done. Apologies for the bad language, by the way.
We've all apologised today.
I should apologise for the bad language.
To give you a fair reflection of the papers, we don't have time to get into it, really, and I don't know if there's much appetite.
Look at the front page of the Sunday Times. Look at the size of this goddamn front page on the Sunday Times. Look at the size of that. You know, and you can only give 1,000 words to Robert Hood, and you do this, you know.
Point made. Martin O'Neill stuff's everywhere, by the way, if you're thinking, does that feature heavily in the pages, and it generally does. So Kevin Gaban's talking about the basics not being right. There's various pieces. Stephen Hunt was really disappointed the other night. Paul Roan looks more at the FAI, does ask an interesting question. You know, O'Neill, and he makes the point that this report hasn't been rejected or clarified by the FAI, is getting 1.9 to 2 million a year, Keane another 600,000. And he makes
the point,
you know, when Dennis O'Brien was subsidising about 70% of O'Neill's salary, the figure was believed to have been 1.1 million per year. He says it's extraordinary the FAI should take up the slack left by O'Brien withdrawing his subsidy and then pay a massive premium on top of that, almost doubling O'Neill's salary, according to reports which have not been denied by the FAI. Surely such a splurge was not necessary to see off the advance of Stoke City. Again, that may be a question that John Delaney can clarify at his AGM or whenever he gets a chance to speak. But it's a point worth raising, I think. There is taxpayers' money involved.
Lovely column by Dermot Gillies.
Oh, yeah. The margins.
Golf column, the margins of making it and not making it as well.
Yeah, there was a great quote on that by the golfer. He was brilliant. Tim Rice, I'd never heard of him. So, you know, he came through with McDowell and Michael Hoey and Noel Fox and didn't quite make it. But he makes a really interesting point, which is so true about golf.
You can identify with...
Yeah. Though I play tennis, I couldn't... Well, I can't identify with this point.
No.
He says, though I play tennis, I couldn't hope to beat Roger Federer. He says, at golf, though, I could go out and beat the best player in the world on a given day. That's what makes the game so damn frustrating, which was a really good point. And yeah, the point I could relate to was Barbara Teller says that the reason you get so angry when you make a mistake playing golf, for the lesser player, by the way, sorry, is that they know they're going to repeat that error. That is the like vacuum you get sucked into instantly when you make a horrible mistake. Right, are we done?
Yes, I think everyone has apologised enough. I'm numbed into silence here now,
okay.
with apologies to all Simon Zeebo's fans and Simon himself. If I gave him a hard time,
I'd like to apologise again for the
Bad language. Okay. Sincere apologies
like
all
to
around.
Apologize. You,
nothing. I've done nothing wrong.
No, you did. There was one. What was his?
You're responsible for his bad language.
You attacked me for the Tommy Conlon point. That's two apologies and none for me.
Oh, I thought you did apologize.
He did.
Oh,
he
I got the WWE WME thing wrong. Okay. But they're both entertainment companies, by the way.
Okay.
So I think.
No. BBC and ITV are both broadcasting companies as well. You know, very different.
That is the papers done. So Andy Dunn will come in and talk to us about the rugby very shortly. And we'll have Johnny Walters making his commentary debut as well on Off the Ball in our 4 o'clock game. And obviously updates to come from Leinster to Toulouse. Back in a second.